Okay, so this is on Tony Cliff's book, part of the Great Books of Social Theory, or whatever the stream is called. And so I'm going to start today with a quote from a document called The Nature of Stalinist Russia. It was actually an internal document of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It was written by Tony Cliff. Cliff was a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is a British Trotskyist group at the time. And this was written in 1948. And just to note that it was from this document that state capitalism in Russia was actually, you know, further developed and sort of completed. And Cliff wrote, "The class struggle in Stalinist Russia must inevitably express itself in gigantic spontaneous outbursts of millions. Till then, it will seem on the surface that the volcano is extinct. Till then, the omnipotent sway of the secret police will make it impossible for a revolutionary party to penetrate the masses or organise any systematic action whatsoever. The spontaneous revolution in smashing the iron heel of the Stalinist bureaucracy will open the field for the free activity of all the parties, tendencies and groups in the working class. It will be the first chapter in a victorious proletarian revolution. The final chapter can be written only by the masses, self-mobilised, conscious of socialist aims and methods of their achievement, and led by a revolutionary Marxist party." Now, I wanted to start with that, despite its lack of brevity, because I think it highlights several of the key elements of Cliff's work and the significance of his theory of understanding Russia not as being socialist or a form of socialism, but rather as being a different form of capitalism. So leaving aside the sort of like direct contours of his prognoses, what was going on, the quote is centred around an understanding of the class divisions within Russia itself, of an oppressed working class with counterposed interests in a regime which controlled it, with working class action and revolution at the centre of any transition towards actual socialism. Now, so just that, Cliff himself, I presume most people know something of Cliff or have heard of him before. He was born Yigael Gluckstein, I apologise if I pronounced that incorrectly, in 1917, in what would soon be the British-controlled Palestinian Mandate. He was involved originally in a number of political groups, including left Zionist groups, before he became convinced of Trotskyist politics in the early 1930s. It's quite an interesting story, and I think quite a nice story, about Cliff being speedily converted out of Zionism and Zionist thought by observing the treatment of Arab children around him. And at the age of 13, he wrote in a school essay, "It is so sad that there are no Arab kids in this school." And his teacher immediately scrawled in a great big red pen across the page of his essay a single word, which was just communist. And he stayed true to that throughout the rest of his life. And he dedicated his life to building a revolutionary party of the working class that was centred around the notion of the self-emancipation of the working class as being absolutely fundamental to Marxism and liberation. It was something that couldn't be overlooked and that couldn't be erased. So from the mid to late 1940s and early 1950s, he sort of arrived in Britain via Ireland and was involved in the Trotskyist groups there before launching a number of sort of groups that led into the modern day Socialist Worker Party, which is obviously active over in Britain, before he died in the year 2000 at the age of 82. And State Capitalism in Russia, the book, obviously, and the ideas that Cliff argues in it, was part of the fundamental project of Cliff's life. It was part of his contribution, which is aimed not simply at winning academic points or anything like that, but rather of clarifying ideas of the Trotskyist movement, or at least a section of it, and coming in terms to the reality of the situation as it was, not as people would have preferred it to be, and to build a revolutionary party around such politics. Now, Cliff saw his contribution on the nature of Stalinist Russia as being a corrective within the Trotskyist tradition. That's, while maintaining Trotsky's tradition of internationalism and opposition to the Stalinist bureaucracy, Cliff aimed to restore a number of the key elements of Marxism that had become lost in Trotsky's understanding of the Stalinist states. So I've got to explore what sort of Trotsky was arguing and then sort of go over Cliff in response to what Trotsky wrote. Okay, so on Trotsky. Facing an unknown situation, which was the degeneration of the world's first worker state, Trotsky struggled to try and understand the developments that had been taking place in Russia subsequent to the revolution. Firm to his opposition that the bureaucracy that had begun to develop from the early 1920s onwards, Trotsky couldn't conceive, though, that this social layer, which is sort of symbolically headed by Stalin, was capable of coalescing by itself into a new ruling class. He didn't believe that they had a collective interest in the control of production. Instead, he thought that the greatest danger to the revolution and the revolutionary legacy, the worker state, lay within capitalist elements developing, such as wealthy peasants, small traders, people who've been somewhat enabled with the new economic policy. And he didn't see the main danger as coming from the bureaucracy itself, which he considered to be centrist, sort of balancing between the working class as it existed and the sort of, you know, what he considered to be developing neo-capitalist elements. And bureaucracy sort of zigzagged between the two in different periods of time in its attempts to hold power. And Trotsky's ideas very much developed with the unfolding of events. You know, he didn't just have the same complete idea from start to finish. You know, from his own expulsion from Russia and a subsequent hounding by the Stalinists of him, his family, his supporters, the capitulation of the Stalinist Communist Party in Germany to Nazism, their counter-revolutionary role in Spain, so forth, all the regressive measures that they took, Trotsky basically had to reassess his position on how to relate to Stalinism. So he changed from his early position that basically the Stalinist state could be merely reformed, or you needed to reform to be a true worker state, to believing that a political revolution was going to be necessary to sweep away the bureaucracy. What remained consistent, though, was his insistence that Russia remained a worker state, though it be degenerated. And he conceived of this because the form of production itself remained nationalized, it remained in state hands, something that he believed to be at odds with capitalism itself. So Cliff spends a fair bit of time charting these sort of ideas of Trotsky and his understanding, particularly at the start of the book. And it's very much a launching pad of his subsequent arguments. So there's a few lengthy quotes here, so forgive me for that, but there's no real way around it. So he says this about Trotsky. In Trotsky's works, we find two different and quite contradictory definitions of a worker state. According to one, the criterion of whether a state is a worker state is whether the proletariat has direct or indirect control, no matter how restricted, over the state power. That is, whether the proletariat can get rid of the bureaucracy by reform alone without the need of revolution. And so he quotes Trotsky from his early work in 1931, where he argued, so this is Trotsky, the recognition of the present Soviet state as a worker state not only signifies that the bourgeoisie can conquer power in no other way than an armed uprising, but also that the proletariat of the USSR has not forfeited the possibility of submitting the bureaucracy to it, of reviving the party again, and of mending the regime of the dictatorship without a new revolution, with the methods and on the road to reform. So this idea here drastically sort of changed and developed, and so by 1937, he changed his interpretation markedly. This is the year that he wrote the book The Revolution Betrayed, which this next quote comes from. And he wrote, the nationalization of the land, the means of industrial production, transport and exchange, together with the monopoly of foreign trade, constitutes the basis of the Soviet social structure. Through these relations, established by the proletarian revolution, the nature of the Soviet Union as a proletarian state is for us basically defined. So Cliff then goes on to spell out the full implications of this argument, whereby Trotsky's understanding, no matter how independent the state machine be from the masses, and even if the only way of getting rid of the bureaucracy be by revolution, so long as the means of production are statified, the state remains a worker state with the proletariat the ruling class. That was his observation of what Trotsky was arguing. Now, in The Revolution Betrayed, Trotsky was implacably hostile to the Stalinist bureaucracy, and he did argue that workers should fight against them, even if this was on a political and not a social level. In other words, they should sweep out the bureaucracy but maintain the basic economic setup of Russia at the time. However, by associating socialism exclusively with nationalization, Trotsky betrayed some of the most central tenets of Marxism. What was being asserted by Trotsky's definition was that the dictatorship of the proletariat could exist without any necessary connection with any actual workers' power at all. The dictatorship of the proletariat under such a definition first and foremost means state ownership over industry and the control over planning. The dictatorship of the proletariat could exist even in a totalitarian police state that mass murdered workers and genuine revolutionaries, that cut deals with fascist and foreign imperialist governments and sort of had an imperialist project of its own. So I'll return to some of these sort of like points later as well, just before noting them, I guess. But I have a couple of elements of Trotsky's argument that are important to highlight, what he was saying by 1937. So part of contesting that the USSR was a form of a worker state was denying that a new ruling class had arisen to subordinate the working class, again, to the forces of accumulation for accumulation's sake. Trotsky explicitly refuted any idea that the bureaucracy was a ruling class, and he refuted any idea that was sort of arisen by some on the left fairly early on, that Russia was a form of state capitalism and, in fact, had been since the revolution of 1917. Trotsky's argument rested here on the fact that the bureaucracy, in his opinion, was a collective unit of administration and did not resemble the actions of the private capitalists in the West. So he said, the bureaucracy is neither stocks nor bonds. It is recruited, supplemented, and renewed in the manner of an administrative hierarchy, independent of any special property relations on its own. The individual bureaucrat cannot transmit to his heirs the exploitation of the state apparatus. It conceals its income. It pretends that as a special social group, it doesn't exist. So he argued there had not yet arisen a new ruling class that controlled production, exploited the working class, and he certainly didn't conceive that the bureaucracy was or could ever fulfill that role. Instead, he said that the bureaucracy arose from the needs of distribution, so that in a society of want, where socialism couldn't be fully established, that the bureaucracy had taken a role on distributing what had been produced. So he sort of like compared it to a policeman who was guarding a line of people at a food shop. And it did this rather than actually controlling the process of production itself. So therefore to him, the Stalinist bureaucracy didn't constitute a ruling class or a class at all, but rather was a social caste. For Trotsky, this situation was inherently unstable. And so at some point, either the neo-capitalist wealthy peasants and traders sort of element was going to succeed in asserting themselves as a new ruling class, or else the working class would recapture the state, and that the current state of affairs with the bureaucracy was reflective of a transitory regime, one that wouldn't be able to survive the pressures of the looming World War, which, of course, was just a couple of years away at that point. And he argued in 1935, the Stalinist bureaucracy, it cannot long maintain itself. Its fear balance on the point of a pyramid must invariably roll down on one side or the other, hence the inevitable collapse of the Stalinist regime. And he particularly expected that the all-out mobilization of the Second World War would see the end of Stalinism, as the social pressure that had been created by the total mobilization would tip the balance either between the working class or the new ruling class that was, new capitalist class rather, that was beginning to try and assert itself. So that was his sort of opinion. And Trotsky, of course, was brutally assassinated in 1940 by the agents of Stalin. And so after the war, Trotskyism itself, the sort of Trotskyist currents that existed around the world, faced intense crisis and confusion. They were small, and most of them did just cling to Trotsky's prognoses of continued economic crisis, which he also argued, and revolutionary movements that he believed would sweep the world after the Second World War. In particular, particularly the sort of small nature of these groups, the isolation they experienced, and the fact that Trotsky himself, the great leader of the movement, had been murdered, sort of really, denuded a lot of the sort of ideological capacity and so forth of these groups, contributed to the pressure and meant they felt incredibly isolated, which I think led quite considerably to them unquestioningly clinging to these ideas. But there were two major questions that did pose themselves to the Trotskyists after the war. So firstly, that the Soviet Union had in fact not collapsed under the pressure of Second World War, but in fact had managed to expand its power and its influence over Eastern Europe, where it created numerous regimes which were cast in its own state capitalist image. And it used its position of military might to hold them in subservience. And the second question was, what actually was the nature of the satellite states that existed in Eastern Europe? Were they also degenerated worker states? And if so, if they were, did that mean that socialism could come, not just by the conscious activity of the working class themselves, as it initially had with the Russian Revolution, but could it come through the rumbling of Soviet T-34 tanks? Now, so initially, to overcome this contradiction, a number of the Trotskyists, basically, they had to delve into a number of distortions in the political positions that they put forward. The first was they simply labelled, by and large, the Eastern Bloc countries as being capitalist, despite the similarities that they had to Russia, which they still considered to be a worker state. So as the Trotskyist Ernest Mandel is quite an important, influential figure in the Fourth International, Trotskyist Fourth International, who had this to say about the nationalized economies in the capitalist Eastern Bloc. So he said, "Nationalizations in no way change the capitalist character of these buffer nations. They merely express in a new and concentrated form the total incapacity of the native private capital of these countries to develop and even to run industry." So I actually think it's quite a significant and quite accurate statement. But the Trotskyist groups that had organized in the Fourth International, they held this position until about 1948. And obviously there's a whole range of different groups, so it's sort of hard to talk about all of them individually, but the broad sweep of them sort of held this position until around 1948, when Tito's Yugoslavia broke with the Eastern Bloc, and he broke with Stalin, which is welcomed by a number of Trotskyists as being the Yugoslav Socialist Revolution, which was, even though Trotskyists in that area were rounded up and shot under Tito's regime. The ideological inconsistency and this flip-flopping that went on is reflective of the confusion, the hopelessness, and the theoretical decay of these groups. And so you have, on one extreme, Trotskyists, I think it's Michel Pablo, is that how you say it in French, Michel? Yeah, Michel Pablo argued that the worker states, that the world was facing now a century of the generated worker states, or deformed worker states, sorry, with authoritarian-run dictatorships becoming the new prerequisite for communism. And it's just a sort of like interesting story I found about this comes from James Cannon, who was an American Trotskyist at the time, when he was talking about how this played out practically in the Chicago branch of the organization that he was building. And he says, a comrade got up and asked me, if there are going to be centuries of Stalinism, what's the sense of me going out and selling 10 papers on a street corner? Which, again, an interesting question. Now, the absolute mess of Trotskyist politics at this time is something that, unfortunately, due to time limits, I don't have any. I'm not really going to be able to go into in great depth. So I said there's a whole range of groups, and this doesn't express by any means all the different positions. And Cliff and others would have to polemicize against a whole range of conceptions of Stalinism. This is primarily just talk aimed at sort of Trotsky's thoughts and the people who continue to hold to what Trotsky said of understanding Russia as a degenerated worker state. But whilst not going into all the twists and turns of these groups, at least in the talk, feel free in the discussion, it's worth mentioning that all the different groups that did hold this position had something in common. All of them that conceived of Russia as being a worker state, and all of those who began to see the Eastern Bloc as degenerated worker states, turned their backs on the fundamental essence of Marxism. Because now it was being argued that you could have worker states where workers had absolutely no control. It was argued you could have revolutions where workers actually didn't play any part. And so, in effect, they'd hollowed out the very core of Marxism and negated any role for Trotskyists to play, besides cheerleading the onward march of Russian troops. So that story about the Chicago branch really sort of reflects that. Now, just a sort of like side note is that there is a number of descriptions as I sort of move into the theory itself. There are a number of descriptions of Russia as state capitalists, as I sort of mentioned before, that precede that of Cliff and the sort of things that he was writing. Now, this isn't true for all of them, but mostly the groups that sort of held these ideas were small, quite often sectarian or anarchist groups. And by and large, they identified the development of state capitalism as originating with the October Revolution in 1917, not from a degeneration or counter-revolution. So this is one of the things the signpost as being one of the importances of Cliff's theory of bureaucratic state capitalism, in that it allows us to maintain our support for the victorious workers' revolution while being able to offer a materialist explanation for its defeat and for the kind of society that replaced it. So, I'm assuming, has everybody actually read the book here?
Oh,
yeah. Okay. I'm seeing a few frowns and, shakings of the head and a very enthusiastic nodding up the back, so we'll sort of like pull those together and have a, we'll set up a happy medium, basically. So anyway, in the book, when you do get around to reading it, those who haven't, and feel free to buy a copy of the Marxism CD and you can listen to this again after reading it, Cliff goes to great lengths to empirically demonstrate the separation that existed within the USSR between the working class and control over production. Actually, I shouldn't call it the USSR, which of course stands for Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, because as Cliff points out, it wasn't a union, there were no Soviets, and it wasn't socialist, so it's my mistake. Yeah, exhaustively in the book demonstrates how life under Stalinism bore absolutely no resemblance to the revolutionary order that had existed in Russia after October. And he locates the defeat of the revolution within its isolation. So he followed on there from Lenin and Trotsky, who had always argued for international revolution, maintaining that due in particular to the comparative backwardness of Russia compared to the more industrialized areas of Europe, it would require a revolution on an international scale to support the establishment of a socialist society. A revolution in Russia could be the first step in this process. And without such a revolution, both Lenin and Trotsky had correctly predicted the strangulation of the workers' state. And this expressed itself in the development of the bureaucracy, which is formed around sections of the Bolshevik Party and the state machinery. The bureaucracy was a result of the utter decimation of the working class and the erosion of Soviet power in Russia. And a layer of careerists and managers who managed the economy and the levers of the state on behalf of the working class and began to rise and were themselves removed from the working class. By roughly 1927, 1928, this social layer had sort of coalesced itself into a self-conscious ruling elite who took deliberate and brutal steps to protect their interests. And there was a necessity for this new bureaucracy, this new ruling class that had developed, to massively increase the rate of accumulation in this period, particularly due to, particularly within heavy and military industries as a result of its military competition that existed with the West. And it's quite a famous quote from Stalin in this period where he said, to slacken the pace of industrialization would mean to lag behind. And those who lag behind are beaten. We do not want to be beaten. We are 50 or 100 years behind the advanced countries. We must make good this lag in 10 years. Either we do so, or they will crush us. And so the bureaucracy that developed used the state machinery and state control to drive a program of economic development forward. And the sheer rate of this program of accumulation really necessitated a pretty severe police state and all the undemocratic measures which they undertook. It's worth pointing out that the actions of the bureaucracy in Russia were not entirely unique in the whole of history. It reflects the pattern of development which has been exhibited by ruling groups in less developed countries the world over, who carry through so-called revolution from above to implant capitalist relations or to fully reassert them. The newly empowered capitalist classes of less developed capitalisms pretty soon discover that they can't compete very comparatively with the advanced capitalist powers by merely imitating the way that they did business. And their needs to catch up in the level of development necessitated really drastic measures, sentiment which is really revealed in Stalin's speech. And they find that the state is a tool to boost the rate of industrial advancement. And so this is a pattern that's been repeated in countries where a ruling group has wanted to defend its national interest and where private capital has been weak. Now, Cliff's theory out of necessity had to elucidate on the very nature of what capitalism was itself and to strip to the core features of the system. One of the key elements to Trotsky and some other sort of Trotskyist theoretical confusions, the nature of Stalinism was a confuddlement over the nature of capitalism itself, which had been associated with its thematic features. So things such as, private and individual capitalism, the stock exchange, competition in an internal national market, and so forth. And so the argument is that Marx himself was actually less concerned with these aspects of capitalism and more within the fundamental dynamics of capitalism which produced these. So Marx identified two major defining features of a capitalist system. So the first is basically the competition that exists between the capitalists, the manner in which individual acts of labour are related to each other not through conscious planning, but rather in an unplanned and anarchic fashion. Now, in this way, each commodity has a price that's determined by a proportion of the total labour of society needed to produce it. And the second is the exploitation of the working class, the separation between the means of production and the producers. Workers being able to survive only by selling their ability to work to those who control the means of production. And both of these features were evident and particularly drawn out within the first five-year plan. It's basic history. Everybody know what the five-year plan was? Yep, so the plan to, march forward for the Soviet economy. And Alex Glinikos from the Socialist Worker Party explores this under the five-year plan. And he says, in many respects, the collectivization of agriculture bears a close analogy with the expropriation of the English peasantry, which Marx analysed, in the primitive accumulation of capital. In both cases, the direct producers were deprived of their land and therefore reduced to a condition where many had no choice but to become labourers in the new industries. And driving this process was a need to accumulate capital, so a necessity for the ruling class under capitalism. And so Marx explains this dynamic. The development of capitalist production makes it constantly necessary to keep increasing the amount of capital laid out in a given industrial undertaking, and competition makes the imminent laws of capitalist production to be felt by each individual capitalist as external, coercive laws. It compels him to keep constantly expanding his capital in order to preserve it, but extend it he cannot except by means of progressive accumulation. Fanatically bent on making value expand itself, he ruthlessly forces the whole human race to produce for production's sake. And this is the underlying dynamic that drove the Soviet Union's industrialization program. Now, while it's true that for Marx's analysis, it was competition between different firms to sell their products that necessitated the drive to accumulate, in Russia, the most central dynamic was the international competition, the international military competition that existed. So effectively, the mechanism was different, but the result was the same. And so this early period of accumulation, particularly under the first five-year plan and subsequent to that, was particularly brutal due to the scale of development that the ruling bureaucracy required to attempt to raise it to a level by which it could compete with the more developed countries. So during the first five-year plan, the consumer goods industries were hardly developed at all, so that while in 1927 to 1928, only 32.8% of industrial development took the form of the means of production against 55% for consumption, by 1932, this had grown to 53.3% of industrial development taken from means of production. And this would actually increase to grow to 68.8% by 1950. So everything above all, the living standards of workers and the peasantry and so forth, was being subordinated to the production of the means of production to produce other means of production. You know, industry grew, but living standards and the cost of this were massively deteriorating. And workers, of course, in this period experienced extremely punitive laws, you know, against strikes and, you know, so forth. And anybody who tried to take them up were, you know, usually rounded up and subjected to the terror of the Stalinist regime. Now, this form of capitalism, the capitalism that existed in Russia, is obviously different to capitalism of the United States and the other Western powers at the time. Production was centrally coordinated and administered in Russia on a scale that hasn't actually been seen in the Western capitalist states, although massive state intervention has, and massive state intervention into the economies has been a feature of Western economies in period of crisis, economic crisis, total mobilization for war, and et cetera. But in Russia and other Stalinist societies, the sort of individual productive units were rarely autonomous or in competition with each other, whereas this form of competition is obviously a feature of the Western market. The structure of the Russian economy lacked this competitive element internally, and as Cliff put it from this, the division of labour within Russian society is in essence a species of the division of labour within a single workshop or within a single enterprise. And I think it's Peter Binns who sort of, you know, then labels it sort of like Russia Incorporated competing, you know, Russia is a corporation competing internationally. So what located the Russian economy as part of the world system was not its internal dynamic, which differed from the rest of the world system, but rather that the ruling bureaucratic class was forced to exploit workers to modernise the plant and equipment to accumulate capital and so forth. And it was forced to do this by the competitive pressures of the world around it. And under capitalism, of course, such competition develops into military competition, and imperialism was a trait very much displayed by Russia, you know, from subordination of the Eastern Bloc to the fighting of proxy wars throughout the Cold War, the invasion of Afghanistan, and so forth. Imperialism was very much a feature of the state. And Cliff's theory also explains the decline of the Stalinist Eastern Bloc and how and why it entered into economic crisis just as the West did, though in a different form to the boom and bust cycle that typifies Western crisis. The Soviet Union's industry's heavy economic development through the 1930s gave Russia the economic base for its war effort against Nazi Germany. And by the early 1950s, Russia had actually become the second largest industrial economy in the world. To give a sense of the advance, this sort of typifies the per head output of Russian industry was 25% of the Western European average in 1929 and was 84% of it by 1963. From this peak, however, the peak that they did manage to achieve, Soviet rates increasingly began to slip, growth rates. Throughout the 1970s, the USSR had an average growth rate which was comparable to the Western economies at the time, even though the Western economies had been affected by two massive recession of the years, and this was around 2.6%. Hello, latecomers. You've just missed so much. I'm going to have to start again. So in the early years of Russia's development, when they were first beginning to industrialise, there were abundant amount of resources permitting industrial growth to take place, you know, developing from a very low starting point, even though the bureaucratic methods of development were not particularly efficient and labour productivity was quite low. But by the time in the mid-1960s, this was no longer the case, leading to a decline in growth rates, and they sort of entered a kind of permanent crisis. And the restructuring of state capitalist economy by the entrenched bureaucracy itself, by the ruling class itself, proved to be a near impossible task, not the least because many sections of the bureaucracy that had gained power and influence in the section of the economy they were entrenched in were not particularly keen on seeing their importance and the importance of the sector that they were most involved in eroded in the favour of another section of the economy. You know, they steadfastly resisted change. And the logic of Russia's position within the world system impeded as a whole the sort of economic reforms that would probably have been needed to halt the fall in growth rates from the mid-1960s into the 1980s, not the least of which would have been to raise the living standards of the working class and diverting resources into the previously stagnant agricultural and consumer sections of the economy. In particular, the counterweight to this was the pressure of competition with the West, necessitating continued high levels of investment in heavy industry and high levels of expenditure in the military sector. And this long-term slide into crisis reached its head in the mid to late 1980s when the regime under Gorbachev attempted to implement some of the Western modes of dealing with crisis, which had become quite popular in the Western world at the time, of mass sackings, factory closures, mass restructuring, all this sort of stuff. But they weren't, you know, wasn't particularly able to do this, and it took the fall of the Eastern Bloc and the fall of Stalinist Russia itself to enable the ruling classes to drastically shift and sort of enter that sort of scale to try and reboot the economy, which didn't go very well for the vast bulk of the working class population of Russia. So that's sort of a number of the key sort of like generalized points about what Cliff was saying in the book. But there's some general points, there's some points in his theory which are in the book which are explicitly responding to a number of the key things which Trotsky said. So I just want to go through some of the key elements, what Trotsky was arguing, and Cliff's rebuttal. So firstly, on the state. Because Cliff spent a bit of time dealing with the nature of the Stalinist state and what Marxists actually say about the state. For as he said, the assumption that Russia was a degenerated worker state led inevitably to conclusions in direct contradiction to the Marxist concept of the state. So he starts this, this section, which is right at the beginning of the book from memory, with numerous quotes from Marx and Engels on the nature of workers' power and what a worker state would look like in contradiction to the monstrous bureaucracy and army of capitalist states, which, in Engels' words, threaten to devour the whole of society. So in particular, Cliff traces their usage of the example of the Paris Commune, you know, sort of extreme political and economic democracy and liberation that was present to its, during its duration, in counterposition to the Stalinist state, which is, you know, heavily bureaucratized, undemocratic, class-driven society. So in particular, he examines the sort of the role of the Soviets and how that had changed, because the Soviets were obviously one of the most important institutions for working class power during the 1917 revolution. But by the time Stalinism had fully asserted itself, it had been reduced to, again in Cliff's words, little more than a rubber stamps with power lying elsewhere. It had basically no democratic rights whatsoever in terms of working class organizing and working class control over the economy or any other section of society. And he goes into detail and says, this is quite, you know, amusing on one level when you think about all the claims of democracy through the Soviets under Stalinism. So he says, of the Soviets, the annual budget is sometimes brought to the notice of the Supreme Soviet months after its measures are already operating. Thus, for instance, the annual budget of 1952, which was effective from the 1st of January that year, was announced by the Minister for Finance on March 6th of that year. Similarly, one finds that while the first five-year plan came into operation on the 1st of October 1928, it was approved by the Soviets only in April 1929. And he goes for, you know, keeps going to try and establish that the Russian state was in no way, in any form, under working class control. And this can seem a bit like, well, why crap on about that now? It seems very obvious for us. But this was actually a major point of contention at the time. So keep in mind that quote from Trotsky earlier. I'll read it out again for the benefit of people who weren't here. That the recognition of the present Soviet state as a worker state not only signifies that the bourgeoisie can conquer power in no other way than an armed uprising, but also that the proletariat of the USSR has not forfeited the possibility of submitting the bureaucracy to it, of reviving the party again, and of mending the regime of the dictatorship without a new revolution, with the methods and on the road to reform. So if Russia was actually a worker state, if the working class conducted a purge of the bureaucracy in a political revolution, it would use the existing state machinery. Wait a second, that's not right. Yeah, well, that is right, sorry. I misread my page. It's not the greatest lying in here. Sorry, comrades. So the working class would be able to use the state machinery to achieve those aims. But on the other hand, the capitalist class, the sort of neo-capitalist that he conceived of, as I mentioned earlier, to restore themselves to power, they wouldn't be able to use the existing state machinery. And out of necessity, they, because it was a working class state and hence oppositional to their class aims, would have to destroy the worker state and construct a new one on its ashes to protect their rule. But the reality was that in Russia, the bourgeoisie could certainly use the key elements of the Stalinist state. When you think about them in their resemblance to states elsewhere, of a secret police, a standing army, the judiciary, all of this to protect their economic rule, whereas in reality, a working class revolution would have to smash that state, standing state, and to replace it with democratic Soviets, workers' militias, and all those sort of things. Cliff makes the point from this. If the proletariat had to smash the existing state machinery on coming to power, while the bourgeoisie could use it, Russia was not a worker state. Even if we assume both the proletariat and bourgeoisie would have required a purgation of the state apparatus, necessarily involving such a deep change as to transform it qualitatively, we must conclude again that Russia was not a workers' state. I think it's quite interesting as well to sort of look that after, the Soviet Union officially collapsed, the amount of people who from the very top echelons of the state machinery maintained positions within the Russian economy, became part of the new ruling class, and so forth, such as Vladimir Putin, the ex-president, now prime minister of Russia. Now, on the question of nationalization, Cliff addressed Trotsky's argument, and it's quite a central argument to Trotsky, obviously, that the lack of a large-scale private property denoted a worker state. And he did this in what I think is rather marvelously titled section, "The Form of Property Considered Independently of the Relations of Production, a Metaphysical Abstraction." That's a slogan to march on with, isn't it? Cliff claims in it that the core analysis of a class society is in a relationship of the producers to production, and this relationship can come in distinct forms. So, for instance, the private property, for instance, that existed under the slave society, under feudalism, under capitalism, may all have formalistic similarities to one another, but are all vastly different. They're from different contexts and different forms of society.
Yeah.
So Marx actually sort of prefigured him here when he was arguing against the anarchist Proudhon in one of his pamphlets. It won't be too much longer, don't worry about it. And he argued, in each historical epoch, property is developed differently and under a set of entirely different social relations. Thus, to define bourgeois property is nothing less to give an exposition of all the social relations of bourgeois production. To try to give a definition of property as if an independent relation, a category apart, an abstract eternal idea, can be nothing but an illusion of metaphysics or jurisprudence. And so the example here that Cliff goes on to answer, goes on to offer, is that of the Catholic Church as it existed in the Middle Ages, where you had the Church owning large tracts of land over Europe. So, for instance, by the time of the French Revolutions, the Catholic Church actually owned 40% of all the land. But the relation between the Church and the peasants were actually exactly the same as between the peasantry and the feudal lords, in which sense the Church was feudal, even though none of its agents, the archbishops, the cardinals, and so forth, had individual rights over Church property. And as he said, it is the relations of production which define the class character of the church property, which was feudal, notwithstanding the fact that it was not private. And so the same, of course, can be said of Russia, insofar as what determined the class nature of society was not whether or not industry was nationalized, but the relationship of the different classes in society to production and the fact that the working class were exploited and production was controlled by an exploiting class. But that, of course, is again a point of contention with Trotsky, who argued that there has no new ruling class had yet arisen in Russia, and that the main threat to the revolution was from this development of a private neo-capitalist class. So as explained, he considered the bureaucracy to be a gendarme or policeman in the process of distribution rather than being the controllers of production. So firstly, there is a link between production and distribution anyway, and he's got this section from Marx, which takes about 2.5 pages, something like that, where he quotes him on this. I'm not going to subject you to all of that, but here's a section of what he decides is important to show rebuttal to this argument. So he quotes Marx saying, "In a most shallow conception of distribution, it appears as a distribution of products, and to that extent as further removed from quasi-independent of production. But before distribution means distribution of products, it is first a distribution of the means of production, and second, what is practically another wording of the same fact, it is a distribution of members of society among the various kinds of production, subjection of individuals to a certain condition of production. The distribution of products is manifestly a result of this distribution, which is bound up with the process of production and determines the very organization of the latter." Everybody get that? So I was getting the same sort of like happy nodding face at the back. But basically, the process, distribution, process, production are inherently linked, so it's a false comparison to draw anyway. And even on a smaller scale, the control of the bureaucracy over production is reflected not just in its conscious and its collective drives to accumulate for accumulation's sake, but even in just purely the disparity between the members of the bureaucracy and the working class as it existed at the time. So Cliff charted how, with the first five-year plan, as this accumulation was taking place, as I said, workers' living standards and so forth were going down, the rate of salaries for all the bureaucrats, all the top party members and so forth, was actually massively rising. Their salaries were, the bonuses that they got were, all this sort of stuff. And they also got access to private villas, to posh apartments, to personal cars, which may have been technically owned by the state, but which is basically there for their use. So even if you just take the doctored stats of the Russian press, you know, in 1937, the maximum salary for a director was 2,000 rubles per month, which is the currency, the ruble. Although they could actually get special pay dispensations to earn more. Whereas if you were a skilled worker, some of the most highly skilled workers, so not what the vast bulk of workers were, you were getting maybe 200 to 300 rubles per month. So it's quite a disparity just existing there, even in formal terms and even by the doctored sort of figures of the Stalinist press. So there's all that. Now, it's a testament to the nature of, say, capitalism in Russia, and I dearly hope comrades from this read the book, or at least read the one I started with, the first document, because there's just still, like, even going through all this, you feel like you've just rushed through a whole bunch of stuff very quickly. Not only does that not give true justice to those points that Cliff was making, but there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I haven't made. If you actually look at the statistical data, the empirical evidence, all that sort of forth that he provides, it can be quite astounding, as well as quite dense in periods. So, you know, you should definitely go away and read it. But I think it's just really testament to the sort of nature of the book and the sort of, you know, importance that Cliff himself ascribed to it and the need to actually write something like this. I think it's an even greater testament to Cliff and what he was doing, that this project, you know, it wasn't just about words. It wasn't just about writing a book that he could see in a library and you can borrow it. You could say, oh, no, great, because I've got a book and it's in a library and you can borrow it and you can read it and that's fantastic and I'm important. But it was part of a project that he committed himself to actually build a revolutionary group, a revolutionary party on clear political ideas that rejected Stalinism and built itself around a conception of true working class revolution and rejected any notion that you could have a you know, worker state of any form without working class revolution. And this wasn't just, you know, purely academic. This also was a tactical consideration. You know, it was part of the way of orienting during the Cold War when you had a whole range of groups arguing different things from the flat-out Stalinists to, the, you know, sort of people, the degenerated worker state, Trotskyists and stuff like that. If you take any example of a time, it sort of really bears out. Just one sort of mentioning, I'm not going to go into great detail because it's not really reflected in the book itself, but is, you know, something like the campaign for nuclear disarmament, where the big sort of issue was, you know, campaigning against nuclear weapons. And you had a whole, you know, sort of group of people who were arguing within the campaign that we shouldn't have nuclear weapons in Britain, but in Russia it was great that they had nuclear weapons because that was the workers' bomb and that was going to defend the revolution and you should have more of it. Particularly in the Cold War, in that sort of context, the theory of state capitalism, of bureaucratic state capitalism, meant that Cliff and the International Socialists, of which he was part at the time, were able to actually condemn the imperialism of both blocs, recognising them as both being capitalist states, and come up with the rather fantastic slogan, or borrow, as some people allege, neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. And subsequently, you know, time and time again, as we can look back with the sort of benefit of hindsight and history, I think Cliff's theory has been proven correct. When you look at, if nothing else, the time and time again, the periods of history where workers have risen up against the Stalinist regime, you know, Hungary 56, Solidarnosc, it goes on and on, establishing workers' control for brief periods of time and posing real challenge to the capitalist rulers of Russia. And particularly, you know, subsequently with the neoliberal reforms and all that sort of stuff that happened in Russia, the idea of what the state actually was, the way it represented you know, resemblance whatsoever to working class control and power was an incredibly important legacy, and it's one that the future defeat of Stalinism and the victory of a workers' revolution will very much be built on.